Mickey and I started out the first time many, many years ago. We've had a lot of our dreams come true. Now we want you to share with us our latest and greatest dream. That's it, right here. Disneyland, seen from about 2,000 feet in the air and 10 months away. I want to tell you about it because later on in the show, you'll find that Disneyland the place and Disneyland the TV show are all part of the same. Now on a site of 240 acres near the city of Anaheim in Southern California, right about in here, we've begun to build Disneyland the place. We hope that it will be unlike anything else on this earth. A fair, amusement park, an exhibition, a city from the Arabian Nights, metropolis from the future. In fact, a place of hopes and dreams, facts and fancy, all in one. Now, next year, our television show will be coming from this Disneyland. But this year, we want you to see and share with us the experience of building this dream into a reality.
In the KSRO studio this morning is our numero uno mouseketeer, Marcy Smothers.
And you are, aren't you?
I think I share that with millions and millions and millions of other fans. Yeah. But
it's so nice for you to come in this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. Number one, I'm crying to hear Walt's voice. Thank you for playing that.
Well, and to celebrate the release of your new book, Eat Like Walt, mm-hmm. The Wonderful World of Disney Food, this is truly a one-of-a-kind book. Is it just coming out this week?
It comes out on Tuesday, September 19th. Mm.
So we're anticipating the release of the book on
Tuesday. Anticipating it, and there would be nowhere, honestly, I want to be than with you guys at the Good Food Hour, because I'm all about Sonoma County, and I'm sort of breathless a little bit after hearing Walt's voice, to be honest. But yes, it comes out on the 19th, and you're my first official interview, and thrilled to be here.
Fantastic. So how did this begin? What was the genesis of doing this? I mean, it's such a great idea, and why someone hasn't done it before, I don't know.
Well, I wanted to write a book about the food of Disneyland because I love Disneyland, and Disneyland is my favorite place on earth. And so I set out to do that, and my agent, who's brilliant, and I thank him for this, he said, Marcy, you have to be really careful because there's so many bloggers, and respectfully, putting out information immediately. What are you going to do differently that's going to be the hook? And so I started doing my research, and I had this idea that Walt intended for the food to be as immersive and entertaining an experience as the attractions. Now, at amusement parks, they're called rides. At theme parks, they're called attractions. And so that was what I set out to do to be different. And I went on a website called Scribd, which is interesting because it's only what people upload to it. Of course, there's not a lot, in Walt's era, not everything's on the internet anymore, obviously. And I found this insert from the Independent Press Telegram where Walt said, "Welcome to the Kingdom of Good Eating, where the food is as fabulous as the fun." And I still get goosebumps when I say it. I knew I had a book. I had proof of concept. And from there, I started my research.
It's remarkable. And how quickly did the Disney PR and management team buy into this idea?
Oh, it took me 6 months to write the proposal because there's not a lot of information. There's a lot of inaccuracies, urban legends that are out there, of course. So I had two great people help me. Tom Fitzgerald, who lives here part-time and one of the top Imagineers. He has a home in Glen Ellen. And my friend Kathy Mangum, who is one of the head Imagineers at Walt Disney World. I would just start sending them pages. Does this sound right? You know, from the Imagineer perspective. And they're pretty educated. And ultimately, I got it to the head of Disney, Andrew Sugarman, to publishing. And he basically tossed me over to his editor, Wendy Lefcon, whom I have a fabulous working relationship with, and I had to go sell her. So my thing was, I said to my agent, I'll come to New York, but not for a Mercy meeting. I'm done with Mercy meetings. We've all had them, nice to see you, And so I walked in, and she said, I'm sold. And she just, from the very beginning, I walked into my agent's office. She really embraced the idea. However, the caveat was the sales team had to sign off on it because we can have the best ideas in the world, but if the sales team doesn't think they can sell it, they're not going to go to the trouble and expense.
So the book is full of wonderful content, which we'll get into, but it's full of the most amazing pictures that none of us have ever seen before. How did you get your hands on those?
Well, I once I had the deal with Disney, which I could only have done it with Disney, then I had access to the four archives, the Walt Disney Archives, the Photo Archives, the Imagineering Archives, and the Art Library Archives. So a lot of my research was in the 50,000 words, but another whole set of the research were in the images. And as I went along, I found that, making friends, quite frankly, with all the different archivists. And every once in a while, they would send, boom, look what I just found. I've never been seen before. So I had tremendous support from everyone in all the archivists. And 90% of these images have never been seen in the world.
Where did you write this book?
Well, that's a good question. A lot at Disneyland. I went to Disneyland a lot. I wrote for my audience, with my audience. I liked to be among my people and Walt's people and feel that energy. And I call in my offices. I'd either sit on Main Street USA with my laptop or on Walt's trainer lot or in Fantasyland, wherever I was writing the Golden Horseshoe. And I would sit there and I wrote. And if not, I was at Acre Coffee in Santa Montgomery Village, and for a while at Franchetti's. And the Franchetti story is hysterical because I'm sitting there and I listen to exclusively Disney music when I'm writing. It's either the Disneyland music or Mary Poppins, or, you know, the soundtrack, which I worship, as did Walt. Disney radio on Pandora. Anyway, I always have my earphones in and I'm working, and all of a sudden I look up and there's like 30 employees and there's a projector and they're talking about their health plan options. I'm like, I look up, okay. Is this a meeting? Yeah, we've been closed since 2.
That's funny.
So were you a Disney kid?
I grew up in Southern California, and going to Disneyland was always my favorite day of the year. And my grandfather took us and spend the night with my grandparents, lay out my clothes the day before, drive in his Volvo down the 405. And my best memories of my childhood are Disneyland memories. And as an adult, I feel excited. It never ends for me that and I've been to Disneyland maybe 80 or 100 days last year. Every time I walk in the park and I see that giant floral Mickey, and I go under the railroad tunnel and see Town Square and the castle and Main Street USA, I'm home. And that's something that you hear a lot from the Disney enthusiasts. You'll always hear that I'm home, because what Walt had intended is exactly that, a safe place where families could enjoy each other together. So this is how I feel about it.
Do you know what's really fascinating about this book? It really also talks about a time in American food when it was real different than it is now. And Walt really kind of reflected that. There was a quote, I can't remember who said it, that he had a hash house lunch wagon kind of appetite. I mean, he was not a fancy food. I mean, he knew what he liked and he ate it every day.
And he ate it often. Yeah, that quote was from his daughter, Diane Disney Miller. Yeah,
which I just loved. But that was also what was going on in America back in the 40s and 50s was... I mean, it's hard to believe now because people have become such foodies and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, mid-century American food was, you know, boiled over. But, you know, as we talk about that, that was even before Julia Child came in and kind of turned around what home cooks were doing. And Walt did like extremely simple foods because he was raised with not a lot of money, and that's what he ate. And he was, as one of my favorite quotes was from his son-in-law, Walt ate like a human being. Why, you know, he said, I don't know why people want to attribute all these grand things to this grand man. He liked hamburgers. Mm-hmm. In fact, he went to a meeting with Westinghouse for Walt Disney World, and they served him lobster salad. And as soon as he got out of the meeting room, he turned to his crew and he said, wasn't that a horrible lunch? Let's go get milkshakes and burgers, you know?
It seemed like Walt had a serious Jones on for chili.
He did. That was, well, you know, it's interesting because, Steve, you know, now I guess I have been given the title of historian, which is amazing, and this little slice of pie, pun intended. It's what was written about the most, but I don't think that necessarily makes it his most favorite food. It's just there's so little written about him in food. I mean, it took me 2 years to find this stuff. Chili seemed to come up, and it definitely was one of his favorite foods, and he ate it in the commissary all the time, and he would put the saltines, extra saltines, in his pocket, and it used to drive his wife Lillian crazy because whenever they went to the dry cleaner, she had to shake out his, you know, really nice, he had great taste in clothes, so really beautiful sports coats, you know, with all these saltine crumbs. So yes, he loved it, but I think he did, there's other foods.
Well, wasn't the other one, which seems to dominate it, and it's all the way through here, is coffee.
Oh, coffee, ubiquitous. He was determined that at Disneyland that coffee would never be more than a dime, and it never was till years and years after he passed away. But in doing the research, I thought it was going to be a time capsule of Walt's life at Disneyland. But once I got into the archives, it became a much bigger book. And it's an entire chapter about Walt at home and an entire chapter of Walt at the studio. And the studio chapter talks about, and this is true, when Walt had coffee, you came into his office, you had coffee. Didn't matter if you didn't want it, you had coffee. And if you didn't finish it, don't be wasteful. You took it to go. You know, so he was, and that is one of my favorite images of the book, opposite the title page in color of Walt at the studio with his black coffee. And because when I started out the research, of course, the first thing I say to the archivist is, can you show me anything with food? And there's just so little. And Mike Buckoff, who was a tremendous asset to me, I'll never forget when he emailed to me late in the game. He said, I cannot believe I've never seen this before. And I still look at it. I get goosebumps when I look at that photo.
It's absolutely remarkable. And Walt, even in the 1930s, was a well-known entity and was asked to contribute a recipe to Better Homes and Gardens, I learned in the book.
Yeah, that was something that I truly also in research stumbled upon. It was called Macaroni Mickey Mousse, okay? M-O-U-S-S-E. Now, that's not entirely unknown. There are other food bloggers that have written about it, but here's the thing. They keep saying it's a typo. And I'm like, no, it's not a typo. A mousse can be a molded casserole. And it's essentially this recipe, which I've made. And I, you know, all the recipes in the book are vintage to Walt Disney and his era exclusively. They've all been tested either by me and my recipe tester. Some of those, there's one recipe we did 40 batches of, but this particular one, you just break pasta. Then that would have been spaghetti, and you know, add all this cheese and breadcrumbs, and you bake it in a mold, and that is what Walt would eat with maybe some bacon added to it.
There are loads of recipes. Mm-hmm. In the book.
Yeah, there's a lot of recipes, and again, all
a picture of America again at a different time.
Yeah. He was very famous, by the way, because when Mickey Mouse made him famous, by the time he was 30, he was, you know, famous around the world. Yeah.
Marcy Smothers is a noted personality. I didn't know this.
That's what Disney writes. Yeah. I don't write that stuff.
It says, in the Northern California world of food and wine, she's hosted several radio programs. Those of you who have listened to KSRO for years know her as an outstanding talk show host. She also included in her resume the Food Guy and Marcy's show with the Food Network Guy Fieri, her love of all things Disney, and especially Disneyland, inspired her to delve into Walt Disney's world of food. She previously authored Snacks, Adventures in Food, Aisle by Aisle. She's joining Chef John Ash and me, Steve Garner, in the KSRO kitchen.
Hot dog! Hot dog!
Hot dogs, that must have some special interest to you, Marcy Smothers, who wrote the book Eat Like Walt.
Well, it was probably one of Walt's favorite foods, but also, you know, in doing the research for this book, you know, I'm trying to find any angle about food. There's so little written. I mean, the archives has very, very little about that. And so when I'm researching Mickey Mouse, I'm like, you are kidding me. Mickey Mouse's first words were hot dog, hot dog. Mm. And it was voiced by Walt himself.
And that was the original from the original cartoon in 1929.
Carnival Kid, the Carnival Kid. And so every time I would see something like that, that told me I was on the right track, you know, that there's going to be enough of these type of somehow through the lens of food stories in Walt Disney that I could write an entire book about. And that's one of my favorite ones.
So one of the things you talk about in the book were sort of the early days, which I didn't know that it wasn't always an easy road for Walt. We tend to think that he was just so successful and that he was always successful, but it was a tough go.
Yeah. I mean, he was born in Chicago, had a very stern father, but a loving mother and, you know, brothers and sisters who took care of each other. And then his happiest point of his life, of course, was Marceline, Missouri. And he was only there for about 4 years, but it shaped him in the sense that his time was quiet. That's where he really started drawing. There was a farmer that he did a few sketches for who paid him a penny for him. And that inspired him that maybe he could actually make a living. And it represents what his sense of America was. And he says, the best days of my life were in Marceline, Missouri, although it was only 4 years. Now, Main Street USA is an homage to Marceline, but it is not Marceline, which is something that a lot of people confuse. It's not supposed to look like Marceline. It's just supposed to embody his memories of Marceline, but with all of his artists and designers and Imagineer, also what any town USA would be like.
Well, we heard Walt and Mickey singing hot dogs, hot dogs. And John, you want to talk?
Oh, it was just, there was another, there's a wonderful picture in the book about that, but you which I thought was brilliant, that where the trash cans were located at Disneyland were the estimate of how long it would take to eat one hot dog. And so then there would be a trash can so that people wouldn't throw their trash on the
Absolutely true. And in this image, I mean, there's so many I could talk about why I love them. But in this image, Walt is picking up trash, you know, and he's keeping his Disneyland pristine with the trash cans that are ubiquitous at Disneyland and now Walt Disney World everywhere with the swinging door. He helped invent those with an engineering company because he didn't want guests to lift the lid of the round trash cans and see garbage underneath it.
He didn't leave one thing unthought about.
Stories and details.
Well, and all through this, you're talking about how he in his various offices, and I guess he had offices tucked away in various parts of the park, that he was always working until very late at night and thinking about the next thing. And
he loved it.
Yeah. I loved the fact of how he would want to blend in with the crowd, sit in a corner and have a cup of coffee or a donut and just watch the people.
Yeah.
He was not in the executive lunchroom.
No, not at Disneyland he wasn't. In the studio chapter, there is a story about why the Coral Room, eventually he did need an executive lunchroom because it was getting just not time efficient for him to wait in line in the commissary like he did for years and years. And by the way, going backwards for a second, you know, he never set out to become a restaurateur, but by 1940, he's 39 years old, when the state-of-the-art studio opened in Burbank, he had four restaurants, and they were all subsidized, like we think of Google and Pixar and Facebook now. He was so far ahead of his time. But yes, when it came to Disneyland, he would spend as much time as possible there. And one of the restaurants, Carnation Cafe, I have a story where they were specifically instructed not to disturb him. And, you know, not that people would, because he liked to be called Walt. He had the first name basis, but he did like to watch. And he would also sit in the morning before the park opened with a notebook and just watch, you know, move around the park and to see how efficiently they were getting ready for the guests that day.
I know you had access to family members. How important was Roy?
Oh, Roy. Yeah, I mean, that there's no Walt Disney Studios without Roy Disney. It used to be the Disney Brothers Studios, and then at one point it switched over when they opened in Burbank to the Walt Disney Studios, and Roy was completely fine with that because his brother was a visionary and he was the financier.
So, but they, without one, there wouldn't
not be
the other.
And a very close working relationship. I just chose to make this a mid-century time capsule of Walt's life. You know, I could have gone, in fact, it was my friend John Lasser that actually we talked about it. He's, because I could go out and out and out and out and talk more about what's happened since then. But once I locked my mind on, this is my tribute to Walt, you know, I'm trying to show a legacy in a different view in his lifetime, then it became very simple to proceed.
And this is about Disneyland. It's not about Disney World, which was a chapter that came later that he didn't have much to do with, did he?
Well, a lot of good first things first, we do call it Walt Disney World correctly. And now, and it was Roy that insisted on that, because at some point, long after Walt passed away, marketing department at Walt Disney World said, hey, you know, let's just switch to Disney World because that's what everybody calls it. And Roy said, there is no way in my lifetime it'll ever be called Disney World, because without Walt, there wouldn't be a Walt Disney World. So Walt started thinking about Walt Disney World that we know about 1965. It was called Project X. He died in December 66. And he was part of the group that bought the land under, you know, trusts in Florida and Orlando. And he did walk the land, but he never lived to see it open at all. But it's interesting how all of his Imagineers, his artists, his designers could carry on his vision without him. He had trained them so well about the Walt Disney way, they knew how to execute.
It was just remarkable. Let's look into the book. Do you know how many photos there are in this book? Do you have any?
Well, I have to give a shout out. I don't. And that's a really good fun fact. So there is, Disney assigned me a company here in Petaluma to design the book. They're called Cameron and Company, and they're rock stars. And so my book designer's name is Ian Morris, and the owner of the company is Chris. Small boutique book company. I love what their tagline is for books that need to be books, but they also just do parts of the process, including the designing. So Ian Morris, who was brought from London by George Lucas to design some of his books, designed this book. And he gets all the credit for the look and feel of it. The only words I said to him is mid-century masculine, because Walt was a very masculine guy. I know. People say, like, where'd you come up with that? That's, you know, but yeah, exquisite. So I don't know how many. The thing that's interesting is at some point, you don't know when you're writing, you're in isolation. I'm very disciplined. I have to be 6 days a week. And I was sending him stuff and he would say, do you have any idea how much this is costing Disney to make this book? And I'm like, no. And he said, because each image, once we select it, it's thousands and thousands of dollars to scan an image. But it shows that they were behind me. And that's when I knew that they were behind me. When Ian told me that, I'm like, they must like the book. Because, you know, you can get cut off at your knees and be told you can have.
Some of the most spectacularly evocative photography I've ever seen in a book.
Oh, my gosh.
Well,
thank you.
And behind the scenes, I mean, there are all of these. I mean, Walt, he looked like a kindly grandfather or great uncle or something like that. Just the sweetest guy, which was true.
I mean, absolutely, which was true. Which I don't try to deify him. I mean, obviously, Walt's my person, and I love him dearly. But yeah, he was a tremendous family man. And, you know, this is more Disneyland probably would be a different environment than the Walt Disney Studios and running an animation and then live action company. But that's not this book. But one of his artists, Herb Ryman, who famously drew the concept map for Disneyland with Walt in 24 hours so that Roy would have it ready on Monday to sell the financiers and the bankers on the money. Herb Ryman, I was thinking this, but when I read this interview with another person, it defined what my goal was. It's for people like yourself to have the privilege and the duty to present Walt as a human being and a person that can be known, someone you can be close to. And I had that everywhere in my refrigerator, in my office. I took it with me to Acre because that's how I want to present Walt as a human being. And food is an everyday thing. It's very intimate and it's very human.
Marcy Smothers is a Sonoma County resident. That's why we get first shot at her.
I love you guys. It's more than that. Yeah.
The new book, which is not out yet, it's called Eat Like Walt, The Wonderful World of Disney Food. It will be officially released this coming Tuesday. If you're a Disneyland fanatic, aficionado, if you ever went to Disneyland as a kid or your grandparents took you, you'll want this book. It's just full of emotional rapport. It's 11 chapters, and you visit each one of the theme parks, basically, is how you do it. And there's restaurant lore in each of the different theme parks. We look at Walt at home, then Walt at the studio. Then we get into Main Street, then to Adventureland, Frontierland, Fantasyland, Tomorrowland, the New Orleans Square. And then we talk about two characters, Oscar and Indian, that worked at Disneyland forever. And one of them, I think, is still there?
Yeah, Oscar is still there. He's the longest employee of Disneyland. He started in 1956.
And he never met Walt. Is that right?
He never met Walt because he was at the Carnation Cafe and you weren't supposed to approach him. But he observed Walt. And he is the number one most requested interview at Disneyland.
And there's a chapter.
Yeah, and I love him. Yeah, and he's – you couldn't have – but what's so interesting is there's two stories about Oscar that the Disney company, Walt Disney Company, Parks Company, puts out the same couple things, you know. I actually went – every time I would go to Disneyland, I would wait for Oscar. Almost Oscar stalker. Truth. And because he would come from, and I would say, tell me about this, tell me about that. And little by little, he would tell me stories. So this is like 2 years of getting a tidbit. And it's all tied together to be, I think, a fantastic history and a legacy for Oscar, who deserves it.
And has Oscar performed the same job for the last 60 years or so?
Well, you know, he did. He came in 1956 and he worked in Tomorrowland, flipping hamburgers and doing basic stuff. But then once he got to Carnation Cafe, he was the cook. And now really he's just the ambassador. When he shows up, he's in his mid to late 80s. He waves and greets people, still sharp as a tack.
And I love Indian, who was the other amazing person. Went on to become the executive chef of the whole thing.
Of the whole thing. And he was like, yeah, I mean, he was never really even learned to cook. He was in the internment camps. He was raised in Hawaii, and then he opens a Jewish restaurant in Chicago. But somehow, the Japanese guy gets to Disneyland. And the story about Indian that's so interesting is his name is Indian because he used to play for the Cleveland Indians, for the B team, AAA team. And Walt was walking around, and he heard people say, hey, Indian. And Walt turned to him and says, why are they calling you Indian? And goes, that's my name. Then why don't you have it on the name tag? His name was Hideo, but you weren't allowed to have nicknames on your name tag. So that was one of it may be the exception that Walt let somebody use a nickname and not their real name on the name tag. Here's the dealio. I had three archivists and the archivist emeritus, Dave Smith, you know, go over this book. Unless you know it imperatively, I couldn't put it in. I have to say, I believe this is what, you know, this is what I think. It's rumored. So I couldn't say it's the only time, but it may be.
I love Frontierland with these photos of Aunt Jemima's Pancake House.
Gosh, I know.
That was pretty wild. And then the Casa de Fritos.
The part of that was really great about that was kind of the creation of Frito-Lay as a company. And Doritos.
Doritos were invented at Disneyland, for sure. Yeah.
And Don DeVore's Silver Banjo Barbecue, really. Kind of, those that are old TV aficionados know the name Dan DeVore. He worked, he was a character actor.
Yeah, Hazel and...
He was Mr. B, Hazel's boss. Yeah. And he was also, was it, not My Three Sons, he was Ozzie and Harriet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thorny, the neighbor.
The neighbor.
So yeah. And he was the only restaurant Walt ever let have at Disneyland that didn't have Walt's name or one of Walt's characters. So the Don DeVore Silver Banjo Barbecue. And his sons are still alive. We talked about, there's a lot of stories about, fascinating about the sauce, because he wanted barbecue sauce. He used to buy it from Love's. And then he tried to figure out how to make it. Anyway, the two brothers went back and recreated their mother's recipe. It took them like 3 weeks. They gave it to me an exclusive. They have their own deal. They never published it just so that it could be an Eat Like Walt. And these are the levels of the relationships and the passion that people share for Walt Disney.
Do you know what my favorite photo – do you have a favorite photo in this entire book? I have one.
Do you? I have several. I don't know if I have a favorite.
Mine, hands down, is the Richard Nixon photo.
Oh, that's
well,
the best
I was just
going
to say, you have to tell that story.
Oh, that's my favorite story. How many times have I said that's my favorite
okay,
today?
Well, wait on that. Wait for the Richard Nixon story. That coming up next. Marcy Smothers in the K.S. Arnold Kitchen with Chef John Ash and me, Steve Garner. Her new book, Eat Like Walt, The Wonderful World of Disney Food. It will be published on Tuesday. But if you're listening to this program, guess what? One of you is going to win an autographed copy of this book today.
Forever let us hold our banner high, 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 high. Come along and sing the song and join the jamboree.
M-I-G-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
Marcy Smothers joining Chef John Ash and me in the K.S. Arnold Kitchen, celebrating the upcoming release of her new book, Eat Like Walt, The Wonderful World of Disney Food. How in the world did Walt get Richard Nixon and the family involved in Disneyland?
I'm going to tell you that, but first, may I give a shout out to Copperfields, because I'll be at Copperfields in Montgomery Village 7 p.m. on the 19th for the big book launch. And they're always my partners, because I love Copperfields and support independent bookstores.
This coming Tuesday night?
This coming Tuesday, 7 o'clock, Montgomery Village. Okay. I'll be there.
People can get signed copies of the book?
Yes, and I'm going to bring Walt's favorite cookie with me. But I'm making
and a hot dog.
Yeah, no, that's another story, the cookie. But to answer your question, so as I said, every single person, no exceptions in my book, knew Walt Disney. So many of the Disney histories, I knew somebody that knew somebody, or my father told me. So one of the Imagineers, his name's Tony Baxter. Now, he only met Walt a few times, but he knew him. And Tony's responsible for Indiana Jones, Star Tours, Splash Mountain, et cetera, et cetera. So one of my, I call him my intern, this gentleman that worked with Walt since 1957, made the introduction to Tony Baxter. And he wrote back to me and he said, "What is there possibly left to write about Walt Disney?" Boom. I mean, that's how it read. Like, yikes. And I said, "Well, this one happens to be through the lens of food." He wrote back immediately and he said, quote, "I have the best unknown food story that leads to the most iconic photograph of Disneyland ever." And he met with me. And the short version is that Walt was, when he was remodeling Tomorrowland in the 60s, he went building his monorail. He would go up to Knott's Berry Farm, where his friend Bud Hurlbut was building the mine train. And that budget was like $1 million. That was a lot of money then. And Bud would take him out to lunch. But they were running out of places because he got recognized and he was disturbed. So he, eventually their net got out to Whittier at a restaurant called Don Nixon's. And that's, again, the story, the quote there about how Walt was eating, you know, taking his bread and mopping up every side and, you know, just devouring the bean soup and putting the bowl back on the, you know, that's the way he was. So when we went back the next time, he said to Don Nixon, "Hey, I want to talk about your soup." That was his guys. And then he says, "It's really good. I like it. Hey, do you think you could get your brother, the vice president, to open up my monorail?"
And so Don Nixon is Richard Nixon's brother and owns a restaurant in Whittier, California.
Two restaurants in Whittier, California. Right. And that is how he did it. And so I found the letter that Walt wrote to Richard Nixon. And so
it's in the book.
And so when I sent that to Ian, my designer, you know, he lays it in there and he says, "I need the high res copy." I hadn't thought about this. The archives may have a copy of it, but Walt Disney sent it to Richard Nixon. So we don't have the original at the Walt Disney archives. So this sends me, as you get to the book and you're running out of time, like my chase. And I called the Richard Nixon Museum. And they were very cooperative. I couldn't believe it. They gave it to me in an instant. They said, I think they're so happy someone had something nice to say about the guy. But yeah, so it just, and then you'll see the photo of Richard Nixon, Walt, and Nixon's two kids, daughters, opening the monorail.
And poor Pat. Yeah. You can barely see her.
I can't see her. And then those scissors didn't work. They were show scissors. And so the girls were trying to chop through it. And so Walt, just famously being the showman, went pop, broke off the ribbon, and it was open.
It is just the most spectacular photo. It stops you in your tracks. It's a beautiful photo. We'll come back. You need to be thinking, Marcy, during this break, your favorite number today between 1 and 15.
Oh, that's so easy. I've got it.
You already have it?
Yeah, it's also Walt Disney's favorite number.
Well, don't tell us that. Keep us in suspense.
Okay.
We'll be right back. because we love Marcy. Okay, so we've got two stories, only two stories, time for two stories. First, tell the story about the cover of this book.
The cover of the book has not been allowed by anybody to over 40 years to be used, and it's believed to have been the last photograph taken of Walt at Disneyland. And so when I was in the photo archives, I kind of earmarked that one because I wrote my dedication to that image of Walt the Mouse. He didn't call him Mickey Mouse. Walt the Mouse, the castle, and his beloved fire engine. And so when it came time to lay out the book and I was requesting photographs, I said to my friend Mike in the archives, I'd like that one. He goes, oh, sorry, that's red tagged. We can't use that. A gentleman that, you know, he's not been cooperative with the company before. I won't name his name. So I wrote to my editor and I said, I've asked for nothing, but I need this image. And so short version is she waited 2 weeks. This person never called her back. And she said, we're running out of time. I look on his website. I call him. He picks up first time. What do you want, kid? And I went, call me back in 15 minutes. I'm sure he's not going to call me back. You could just, he's not. Yeah. So I type the letter to end all letters or email with this image attached to it. And I wait to see, because if he doesn't answer in 15 minutes, I'm going to send the email. He picks up. Yeah. Well, I don't see what the problem is. Just send me an email. And Danny at, you know, business affairs at Disney knows me. I send him the letter and boom, it comes back. Email. That is not my photo. So they've been attributing it to the wrong photographer for decades. Next, I send out my email to all the different archivists and say, copy them on this. And it was like ticker tape. What the, you know, WTF and what's happening? How could this be? And so while they're doing that, I took out I sent an APB to my usual suspects, all the men that knew Walt, the three or four of the most helpful. And boom, Marty Sklar, that just right passed away, wrote to me and said, Marcy, I set up that photo in August 1966. It's one of three photographers, all of which would have been hired by Walt. So that means now they own it. But then now I'm telling them that they're completely freaked out. But archivist needs a lot of points of, you know, of confirmation. And then my intern, Jim Cora, I call my intern, he said it was Rene Boudreau and Rene Bardot, and he confirmed it. And so as a result, my editor said, that's the cover, because I unlocked a mystery, an asset that's worth gazillions of dollars. And it was his last at Disneyland. Wow. It was August 1966, but his last photo was at Epcot, doing a movie for Epcot at the studio.
And now your favorite number, and what significance is there to this favorite number?
Well, I knew this even before I started the book, but my favorite number is 13, and I always knew that it was Walt's, but I was able to prove it. And
caller number 13, 636-1350, will win the first copy of this book to be given away, really.
Unless you come to Copperfields 7 Tuesday.
Unless you come to Copperfields on Tuesday night to meet Marcy. Caller number 13, 636-1350. Continue.
And so with the 13, I believed in it so much, even my contract ends with Disney and $13. And everyone was like, my agent, the business affairs, like, there's a mistake. There's no mistake. I want it to end in 13. So I set this forth in the beginning. But it's known that the address for Disneyland, a lot of people don't know it, but it's not unknown, is 1313 Harbor Boulevard. Walt's train and his home, his caboose, was 13. He was married on the 13th. And when I saw the 13th that he was married, I started thinking, now I see those 2 points. And the 1313, he was a huge patriot and, you know, 13 original colonies. Oh, but so I tried to prove, because these all these archive people, that Walt chose that address, 1313. A lot of people do believe that, but they don't know why, other than it's his favorite number. The reason why is M is the 13th letter of the alphabet. So 1313 was for Mickey Mouse.
What a story.
Yeah.
Have you told that story before?
Well, you're the first people ever to hear it, because I kept that story really quiet and never talked about it. But I'll tell you, the family members, the daughters who cooperated with me, they were with me on a panel and they said, oh my gosh, Grandpa loved numbers. I cannot believe it. So while I can't say it's, you know, for sure, I have to say this is what this offer thinks. Trust me, I know. And that's why my contract ended in 13. Mm. And that's why caller 13 is going to get the book.
Caller number 13, Eat Like Walt, The Wonderful World of Disney Food, Marcy Smothers. Thank you for joining us. You can meet Marcy and get an autographed copy this coming Tuesday night at 6 o'clock.
7 o'clock at Copperfields.
7 o'clock
Montgomery
at Copperfields,
Village.
Montgomery Village. It's going to sell like wildfire. Mm-hmm. You're going to be known in every country of the world, Marcy.
Oh, my gosh. Steve.
So, from you. And next picture of you will be with ears, right?
Yeah, I should have worn those today. We should all thank you guys so much. It means the world to have had my first Eat Like Walt interview on the Good Food Hour.